history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really need to be told. There are people who have done incredible things for our country, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And we're going to hear quite a story today from 92-year-old John Chavez of Orangevale, California, originally from Fresno, California, and a gentleman who served in World War II, in the Korean War, and in Vietnam, a total of 27 years and 8 months in the military, first in the Army. If he hadn't survived being wounded twice in Europe in World War II, he never would have been flying bombers in Korea and Vietnam. And we'll see how much of that we can squeeze into the program today. But let's start early on. You grow up in Fresno, which wasn't that big of a city back in the 1930s. What do you remember about your childhood growing up with your brother out there in the country?
We did a lot of work on the farm, you know, picking fruit for other people. And out on the ranch there, we worked for the Collegians, too. And then another guy named across the street from where we lived was Pretzler. We used to mow his alfalfa, pile it up, stack it up for his dairy in a great big, in those days I had a big crane that stacked it up about 50 feet high, you know. I don't think they do that anymore. We did a lot of rabbit hunting, pheasant hunting out there. At that time, we didn't have a license, we were just kids, you know, in grammar school. Madison Street School, which is on Kearney Boulevard, and we only had 4 rooms there. And everybody walked to school. We used to walk like about 3 miles to school from where we lived. Ooh. Out by what they call Kearney Park. All the kids would get together, and there was a big canal, I remember, about a half a mile. And people said, well, when it was in the summertime, Todd, he said, let's go swimming. So everybody would get over there in this one area where they had a gate there where they divert the water to the different fields. And we used to go swimming in there. Everybody would be in there naked. I mean, all the kids.
Those of us who did not live through the Great Depression really have no idea what it was like. But being in a rural setting like that, in an agriculturally based area, did you feel the depression? Did you have a sense that this was a little different or this was tough?
Food-wise, you know, we always, you know, had something to eat. As soon as the apricot trees started to turn yellow, we were up there eating apricots. On the way to school, the peaches were ready along, and we'd just go out and eat grapes and peaches on the way back and walking back from school down there. Nobody said anything, but nowadays, you see all these signs, keep out, and there's no trespassing and all that. And back then, you used to go through all the fields. Nobody cared, you know. We had a guy had a big 20-acre watermelon patch, and we go out there in the evenings down there and get a watermelon, just eat the hard part, a whole bunch of us, you know. The guy would be out there, and he'd come out at nighttime when we knew we were out there and fire a shotgun up in the air, and everybody was scattered into the fig trees, and it was a good life. You didn't really know you were really poor. Where we lived, we didn't get electricity until 1946 when I came back from the service.
Wow. So your whole childhood, no electricity at home?
No. We had a wood stove, and we had a pump outside for water, and a two-holder for an outhouse, and we had some sheep, chickens. We just wandered around the fields, and all the summertime we weren't working, you know.
Everybody that I know who has been a pilot in the military seems to trace it back to a moment at some point where that fascination with flying kind of caught hold of them. Right. Did that happen to you as a young boy or later on?
Yeah, when we moved back, we lived in Carruthers. My dad had a ranch. And I remember as a kid, had a big windmill for pumping the water and a big water tank down there. And I remember my dad would go out with the horses in the barn and working in the fields. And he always come back with his pockets full of quail eggs, you know, because they nest there. Mm-hmm. They would fry them for us. And once in a while, he'd come up with a little jackrabbit. And we'd have it in the house, and we'd feed it down. Every one day, it jumped and broke a leg. And after that, no more. But, my folks, I don't remember the deal. But this thing I knew, my dad and my brother, we headed down to Los Angeles. And my mother had taken off down there. And they got divorced, I think it was 1929. Mm. And then we moved back in 1933 back to Fresno. I was born in Fresno, but I was born in Chinatown. There was a Japanese sanitarium or a clinic there. And when I went into the service in 43, you had to have your birth certificate. So I showed my birth certificate, and they saw the doctor. Dr. Yamamoto, and they said, were you born in Japan? I said, no. So, you know, they thought I was because both doctors there in Holistic were Japanese doctors, you know. And so I got drafted on my junior year in Central Union High School, which is out by Viola, in March of 1943. I was still my junior year in high school. So I went to all my teachers. I said, this is in the middle of my junior year. I said, I'm going to give me extra work and all that so I can complete all my junior year. And they did. So I completed that. And after the service in 1946, February 26, I got back home, went back, took a CDT and some classes, and I graduated with the class of 1947. But my class, I went through all the reunions, was class of 44.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one I was. So most of all those people are gone now that I knew. In fact, most of all my friends on Darren Collegian's side that I grew up with in high school, the sisters and all that, everybody's gone except me. I'm kind of like the last of the Higgins. Now I associate with her daughter Debbie and Keith and Wayne, you know, the sons, you know. So when I go out there all the time, they go out to lunch.
And, you know, this is something that happened and you've been used to it for more than 70 years. But how'd you feel about that at the time? I mean, here you are in high school. I'm sure you had ambitions, dreams, probably had sports to play or people to hang out with.
When I came back from, we moved from L.A. back to Fresno, and I had a bunch of kids there and played, and I had an old Army belt in the canteen where I got, I don't know, but we used to play soldier and all that. And then we were out in the ranch in the country. I used to build model airplanes. We'd go out towards Kerman, Tranquility, Mendota, and fly them out there, you know. But I was interested in aviation. And at Chandler Field right there by Kearney Park. And I'd go down there and just walk the hangars, talk to the people, you know, and I was really interested in aviation and flying, you know.
You didn't have a chance to do that in World War II because they draft you out of high school into the Army. Did that derail some plans that you had?
Well, it slowed them down. But I got drafted in Fresno, and they sent me to Presidio Monterey. I was there about a month. It was a uniform. In fact, they were running out of uniform. We had the old Army blue fatigues and the old floppy blue hats at that time, and did some drilling. Then I got assigned to Fort Mason in San Francisco, right there by Fisherman's Wharf. And while I was there, I was talking to another friend of mine, Boyle was his name. He was from Oregon. He said, hey, we ought to put in for aviation cadet. And I said, yeah. I said, are you interested? I said, yeah. So we went to the 4th Army headquarters, which is in San Francisco, and applied for it. And we had to take a physical, pass a physical, took written tests, and we passed those. We had to take some what they call a psychomotor test. They had different things. They had like an old cockpit in there, and you had the rudders, and the rudders had springs on them. And then you had a stick, but the stick on the bottom had a spring where you couldn't, it wasn't stiff, and you're moving, it was just, it would give way. And then you had switches on the right, and I remember on the left with a red and white color. Well, and you had a target in front, and by keeping the rudders, trying to keep them centered, aiming at that, and then the light come on, you reach over and turn it off, and you're still trying to keep the line up on the target. If you had too much on one side, it would just flop over like that, and you had to really press in down there in those springs to get it back to the right. And I remember another one they had was like a turntable. On the turntable had a round piece of lead in the middle, and then you had this handle with wires on it, but it had like a pointed, but before you get to the point in the handle was a spring, so if you put any pressure it would just bend. So you put the tip of that instrument on that thing while the turntable's going around, and you got switches over here, and you had to keep it going around with your hand in a circle, and the lights would come on, you had to turn the light off and turn it off up here, and you're still trying to keep that. If you put any pressure on it, it wouldn't go, it would bend, you know. And then you had the, where they check your depth perception too. You have a string down here, and they would set them, and you got to line up these two poles there where they're even, you know, a certain distance, check your depth perception. I passed all that, and then I was assigned from there. I got my orders from Fort Mason. I went to Buckley Field in Denver, Colorado, aviation cadet training. I was there about a couple of months, and we did exercise and some other tests. And then I was assigned from there. We got our orders, and we went to Bozeman, Montana, Montana State College, aviation cadets. And they took us by train in every little town along the way. And we'd stop there. We'd get out, and we'd march, and we'd sing all these songs, you know. And then back on the train, and then we finally got to Bozeman, Montana College. And there weren't that many men there. There was cadets there already, but we took over one of the, called Ham Hall, was a women's dormitory. I think it was three stories. We had that whole deal, and then we had another one. And then we'd take classes there, swimming classes. At the little airport, they had the old Luscombe. It's a high wing like a Cessna, and we get 10 hours of flying time. Well, I didn't get it to get the full time. Just around January, the Army said, well, we didn't know about D-Day. So they said, well, we're going to lose like 300,000 men in D-Day landings. Where we're going to get all the replacements? So everybody that transferred from the Army had gone already finished basic at Camp Stoneman there from when I was at Fort Mason, did all the firing and all that. So I said, where are we going to get all the replacements? So what they did is everybody that transferred to the Army Air Corps were transferred back to the Army. So I wound up from Montana State College on a train, and we stopped Anaconda, Missouri, and we picked up more GIs or aviation cadets to Washington University, and then all the way to Corvallis, Oregon. Ambassador, Oregon at that time was the biggest city in Oregon. We had two divisions there, and each division had like 14,000 men. We got trips into Portland, to Vancouver Barracks, and did all our field training, and, you know, again.
And how'd you feel about that? Because, I mean, you think you're going to be flying. You're going through all this training to fly, and now they make you a grunt.
Well, when we passed our last parade, our commanding officer was a major there, and everybody come down, and I think everybody was crying. So he had tears running down his eyes to see us all go, you know. So by the time we got to Camp Adair, Oregon, they had the band there, and they had another train that came from Southern California, and they pull, I think, one out of five 2 weeks before graduation. These cadets already bought their uniforms and all that. Talk about people being mad and all that, and back to the infantry.
Yeah.
So I wound up in the infantry from Camp Adair, Oregon, and we got sent to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, down by the Lake of the Ozarks. And it was nothing but rocks. Where I dig foxhole, it was nothing but rocks and oak trees, you know. So we did night problems, did all this stuff again, and we got our orders. We transferred to Camp Miles Standish out of Boston. And there was all tar paper shacks, we used to call them, and then had coal burns at each end, you know. To keep you warm, and we guys would take turn who's going to keep the fires going. We had that at Buckley Field too, and one night I woke up there and I looked at the stove and it was red hot. The guy poured the coal and then went to bed. See,
oh man,
burned it down, you know. And anyway, it was the same thing. Then they took us to Boston, and we loaded on the USS West Point, which was the old cruise ship called the SS America at that time. And then the Navy took it over and took off from Boston to southern France. I think it was about 6 or 7 days. Our bunks were down about 35 feet below the water line. They had to climb up all these metal steps, and they had the bunks for about 8 high, a little stretch canvas, you know, for bunks there. I had one of the top ones. I was up between the vents up there, and all these guys down below, when somebody gets seasick, and they hang over the side, and boy, they just vomit all over the place, and I was safe because there's nobody above me. And the cruise ship had the old stairs going around on a corner. These guys, we walked there, and the boat's rocking, you know, turning, and all these guys would vomit. Our mess hall was in a swimming pool where they fed, and they had long tables, maybe about foot and a half wide with a little rail, long ones. You ate out of your mess kits, and you had to wash the mess kits after you're sitting there, and you're looking right next to another guy, and you see him going, and boy, the guys would get seasick, and they're vomiting all over this little trays, you know. And I spent most of my time upstairs in the bow and the aft down there instead of downstairs, you know. First few days are rough because as you go out of Boston, the first 2 days, because, you know, the earth goes down, the water really is rough. Once you get beyond a certain amount, then it's smooth out. We had guys who were in the bunk seasick and didn't come out for 6 days.
And what about if you took the time to contemplate what was waiting for you once you got there? I mean, were you a little nervous about this, anxious?
Well, I don't know. Our ship went by itself. It was fast. And we picked up a destroyer escort in the front. And I remember going down and seeing the Rock of Gibraltar there on the left. You can see North Africa on the right. It's on, you know, it's not that far apart.
Yeah.
As we were going down through the straits here, this British corsair, he came down and he dived right across the bow about 50 feet off the water, and he turned and he rolled it. And so we landed up in this side of Marseilles, and went off there in barges. Went on the barges there, and then went up to, they called CP2. We were there for 2 weeks, nothing but rain and mud. And then they put us on by the old railroad called 40 by 8.
40 men or 8 horses?
Yeah.
When did you get there? When did you land in southern France?
I think it was December the 16th of 44.
So right about when the Battle of the Bulge is starting a little bit away from there.
Yeah. So it took, I think, 2 or 3 days to get up by Strasbourg. We went up, there was Saginaw, and we stopped south of the little town of Bishweiler, but we didn't know where we were. They dropped us off after getting about 20 miles. We had to hike the rest of the way in there because they couldn't, you know, because the Germans were still in that Colmar pocket there. People stayed in different places. We had an old farm there, an old barn there was all torn up, and that's where we slept. And then we just started patrolling through the woods in the night, and then we moved up to the Maginot Line. We spent a couple of days there, and they're not occupied at that time. Next day, they pulled us out. We went to Wingens or Mortars, a little village below the call, little town of Bish. It was a night in the trucks. We didn't know where we were. We went to this little town of Reichstag. Oh, he says, the Germans taking this little town. There's only about 50 Germans in there, you know. It took us over a week to take that town over, and we lost our company. I think we lost about 27 were killed. And we were fighting the 6th SS Mountain Division, and I think it was 357 Volksgrenadier Division, too. They all came up there. This was right at the same time that the Battle of the Bulge was ending, so Hitler decided he wanted to have, that was the last big battle, to the Severn Gap, coming across this way in Haguenau and Strasbourg, and the Germans from Colmar Pocket were going to meet him up here, you know, come out of that pocket. They were surrounded. We lost our company commander the first day. Well, I lost a lot of friends there. I was a BAR man there, and there was a railroad that went right through town. There was a tunnel, and the Germans all back here, they tried to go through that tunnel into the town, but they got stopped in time. We even sent a tank, and the tank was knocked out. And we had a couple of little, not villages, but like housing areas all on the side there. And so we were up this hill, and the Germans had come down a big hill there. It's called the Heikenkopf. They came down, and it was wintertime, cold, and they all had white uniforms and white and all this. And they came running down the woods on B Company, which is off to the side. They went up there, and these guys told them, well, the Germans are back there. You guys dig in. So B Company went on to the right of where we were. They dug in, and while they're digging a foxhole, the Germans made a counterattack and wiped practically them out. A lot of them retreated and came back. We were on this side of the little valley, but you can see the pike. And then later on, we had to go take these houses, which on this side of the railroad, and clean them out and take that hill where they came down from. And I toured down there in 05, took my son down there, and you can still find rifle grenades between a tree there with a tree around it, you know. All kinds of stuff there. And anyway, the other regiment, the 274th, they took over. But when the Germans came down off that hill and over the town, they captured about 250 somewhere in there of the 45th Infantry Division, which we were working with. What happened there is they were all asleep. You know, they didn't expect it. All of a sudden, the Germans had sneaked down through an area and found there was no GIs there, and they came down. It was three companies and a big battalion, and about 900. We think that everyone had a machine gun. We lost a lot of people there going house to house. And
well, and as I hear you describe all this, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. Yeah. You're a 20-year-old kid from the country that didn't even have electricity in your house growing up. Now you're all the way across the world in the coldest winter they've had in decades, and everybody's shooting at you, and your buddies are dying. What could possibly prepare you for that, and how did you cope?
I don't know. You just did, I guess. So.
Had you formed friendships, relationships with some of those guys who were killed?
Yeah, a good friend of mine, Dally, he was a Mormon from Salt Lake City. He was killed in Forbach, same time I got wounded. We had come down from the mountains up here, took the castle and come down the hill. There was a big ridge there, and we came up to the ridge, and we were looking down to all the houses in the town of Forbach. And all of a sudden, we hear this tank come up to the side of the ridge. And we're sitting in the ridge looking right at him, like 50 yards away. And you can hear the mortar, and then when he stops, you hear all the spring going, squeaking, you know, kind of. And then you hear this mortar going, you know, coming in, aiming right up the ridge, and he fired a shot. And my assistant, you know, BAR carried ammo too. He's right next to me, Ross was his name. And we looked at each other and said, well, what? You know, well, you're shooting above us in the trees, you know, this way, so you don't get the tree burst. But everybody was down here. We looked around, everybody's gone. We're down getting behind the hill where you can't, you know. But you shot about six times down there, and I'm sitting up there. Well, now I think back, I said, man, I should have just got my BAR emptied in his barrel or something. And, you know, then he starts backing away, and they went down in between the houses and all that, and had a big railroad track going across Forbach. And that's the biggest town in France that was liberated by us, the 276th Infantry. They even got a street named after us there.
As well they should. It's break time, but when we come back, we're going to find out why that spot on the French-German border, Forbach, nearly became the last place John Chavez ever took a breath. how he suffered serious wounds in Forbach, not just once, but twice in the span of a month in 1945. Check out the photos and videos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 92-year-old John Chavez of Orangevale, California. It's right outside Sacramento, where tourists like to flock to sites like the State Capitol Building or perhaps historic Sutter's Fort. If you ever have the chance to visit Forbach in France, you'll be gazing admiringly at the Castle of Schlossberg, which historians surmise was first constructed between 800 and 900 years ago. When John Chavez was there in wintry conditions in early 1945, wielding his Browning automatic rifle with Company I, 276th Infantry Regiment of the 70th Infantry Division, he didn't have the luxury of sightseeing. Mr. Chavez takes us back now to that bitter fight for Forbach.
There's a big castle there. Well, I Company's on the left. We came this way, and we were the first one to get all the way down the railroad. But I Company, those walls in that old castle are 10 feet thick, and they had to come up a hill, I Company, on our left. They took it the first time, and then they got, next day they counterattacked and they were driven off. And then they went back the second time, they're driven off. And the third time they went up, they finally got them, and the Germans retreated. But we were on this side of the castle area. They had a gate. It was like an old ball field, soccer field here, but they had a wall with a gate, and somebody blasted the gate, and then we started going in that way. Well, I lost a couple of friends in that same ridge. They weren't that end of the ridge. We were at this run after the tank left, and they were digging foxholes, sitting there, and had snipers all over in the castle, and it's a big area down there, and one of them got hit right through the neck here. Graybill, his name was Graybill. And as we were going down, the streets were old houses down there, and the Germans would move to one house, and we'd be in the next house. And the next night, they'd move one more, and we'd move one more, you know, and throwing hand grenades down the cellar and, you know, and firing. And they had their machine guns, this one patio firing up to us. We got around it. And then that night, we got about halfway into town. There was a big wall going down there with an underpass going under the railroad on the right. And I remember we took this house over. One of the guys, just before that, it was a German running across the street, so he shot him. The guy fell over, and then I guess they, by that time, nighttime. So we took that house over and went down in the cellar, and there was a pan of fried potatoes there. So we started eating. The potatoes was still warm, and then there was a guy laying in the bunk. There was the guy that ran across the street, the German, so we picked him up, put him out in the patio, and the rest of the guys are in the basement. I was upstairs. It was in a corner house, and it had like a front end in the living room. There was a side door here coming up. Well, I had this guy, Ross. I said, you watch that. He says, I'll be up here in the front with the BAR. And the other guys are taking a break down in the cellar. About 11 o'clock, we hear the Germans had these hobnail boots, you know, coming on pavements, all kind of brick pavement. They came up the side, right up to the side door. They thought they still had that house, see? It's two Germans. I don't know if they were officers or what, you know. When they came to the door, and Ross, he really panicked. He hollered, it's a German, it's a German. They turned and they ran this way and started going down the street, and I'm in the front there, and I opened up on them, and I hear them hollering and going down, and I don't know how far they went, so I didn't, you know, next day. But and then worked our way up in the town, and then we got up to the railway embankment, and there was warehouses along there, all, you know, big old warehouses. So we got on this one warehouse. We're up in the second story, and you can look over the railroad embankment and see rows of houses. And once in a while, you see the Germans run from one house to the other, you know, across there, but doing so fast you couldn't get a good shot. We sat there and they would mortar us from way over the hill, and you could hear the mortars when they sound like somebody coughing. They go, you know, and then pretty soon, and then we'd hide, and boom, boom, and it hit on the roof. So Ross and I, there was a, like a chimney here, and there was about this much space. So we were back there in this corner, you know, trying to avoid them. They're hitting the roof and all. Sergeant Neiman, my platoon sergeant, was by the window there, and the other guy was in the corner. And the one here, one landed right on the edge of the roof. All I heard was Sergeant Neiman says, "Help," you know, so he got up there and we ran to him, and he was falling down and he was still alive. So we got other guys and we got a stretcher, put him on, the four of us, and we ran across this, like a town square. We had trees but nothing there, and then the buildings down there, and we'd run across, and pretty soon we hear them, the mortars going off on the other side of the hill there. So we lay flat, and then they boom, boom, knew we didn't get hit. All over. We run again, then we duck down and took them down to the medics who were in a great big building there. And Nemus's friend was our, he was in our headquarters, company headquarters, but he was the bugler. He was there with the medics and put him down there, you know. And the guy's examining, he says, he's dead. He said he was dead. He had a little hole like that, a piece of shrapnel went right here, right in his heart. You see the hole, but we didn't notice it. You know, at that time, we said, help. We thought he was still alive. So we carried him about a half a mile down to the medics, you know.
So you guys risked your lives to get him help, and he's dead the whole time.
Yeah, we didn't know it until we got down, and the medics said he's dead. And they showed the piece where it went right through his heart. You know, just a small piece.
All these things are happening. You know, you're describing it, and it's a lot for us to digest. I'm just wondering, for you, when you see guys that you've known get killed, get wounded. I mean, there are Germans coming to your door. The shells are flying all over the place. I mean, isn't that scary? Don't you wonder when it's going to call your name?
Yeah, well, it did. Anyway, they would come over. Everybody said, I'm glad it wasn't me in that same area. After our name was, we took them back, and then we started moving in again up and taking the big building where, well, it's kind of hard to describe there. There was a street here and a street here, and it ran into that big area where the Villa, they call it, building was, big town, empty square there. The Germans were up there. We had moved up to this one, and they went to the next row of houses. So we're sitting there, and we're walking back between the streets there, and we could see the guys and the machine guns sitting way up in the corner, you know, behind it. But we were kind of in a, the hill went down like that, so they couldn't really see us, but we could kind of look and see them. Going across, so somebody said, well, we got to get over to this house here so we can move up where they're at. So they said, okay. There was a door there, and the first guy ran across, knocked that door down, and then the next guy ran, supposed to be one at a time. So I'm loaded with hand grenades, BAR 22 pounds. I got 12 magazines over here, trenching tool, my pack, all this stuff. You know, I'm loaded. I can't run that fast anyway with all that stuff. So I started to run across, and the guy behind me is supposed to wait till I get across. Well, he didn't wait. He started running at the same time. As we got even with me, they opened up down there on me, and I got hit right through the helmet with a machine gun. I hit, well, I don't know if you can see it, right here.
Uh-huh. I see the scar.
There and a couple little right in here. And it came out the back end about this big. And went around and came out the back. So I had a hole this big in the helmet.
Well, and since we're on the radio, I want to describe this for the listeners, but I will take a picture, if you're willing, and put that at hometownheroesradio.com. So it hit you right in the front of the helmet.
Yeah. Well, I was running at an angle like this, and they were there firing. It hit there, and it hit right up in here and came right across through here. Yeah.
It came through your helmet, or helmet went into your skin?
No. The bullet went right through the helmet.
Right through the helmet and left a hole in the helmet a couple inches in diameter?
No, the regular 8mm. But when it came out the back end, it was a hole this big.
The back end of the helmet, it exploded.
And when it hit me, I was running. When it hit me, it knocked me out, and I fell forward in the door. And when they saw the helmet and they saw the blood and all that, and the guy saw I was dead, and it just kept on going.
Because you have the scars you just showed me. One is right between your eyes above the bridge of your nose.
And, well, you can feel the hole here.
Further up above your left eye.
Yeah, right there.
Maybe an inch or two above your left eye. Right so there. I can see why they think you were dead. You got holes in your head, and there's blood all over the place.
Yeah, and they saw the helmet and all that, and they kept on moving. And I came to, I had an old French couple there, gray-haired lady and a guy in there. I had a towel and they were wiping the blood off there. They hauled me back to the medics.
You say you came to. What is that like to gain consciousness and realize that you've been shot in the head?
Well, I don't remember. I just remember, you know, the people, you know, I came to there. But getting back to that same story, those same bullets came back. Okay, right across the street here, there was a driveway. Mm-hmm. You know, in the driveway, like a garage that had a big gate, but the gate was open. It had about this much on each side. Well, our company platoon leader, Lieutenant Zisch, three or four were lining up here, and some guys were lining up just for protection, you know, from that corner where it was all open. They're looking right down the street. Well, the same burst from that guy, the German, that got me, the bullets went back there and Dally, and they hit a hand grenade on him and blew up and killed three more, including Lieutenant Zisch and Dally. I didn't know that until after I got back, you know, that they had been killed.
Well, and it kind of sounds like, I mean, not only could you have been killed, you probably should have been killed.
Yeah.
When you look back and knowing...
Well, yeah, when I look back and I said, say, you know, why didn't that guy wait, you know? He's in a hurry to run across at the same time. Well, they said, well, I got two birds instead of one, you know?
Yeah, made it an easier target. Yeah. But where you got hit, it sounds pretty miraculous you weren't killed.
Yeah.
What was the extent of the damage to your head?
Nothing. I got shrapnel back in my head, though. Still in my head.
Still in there.
I didn't find that out until 2007. Took my wife. Always go to the Mayo Clinic, you know, for 10 years. Had liver. And I went down there and I took some pills or something. So I was sitting there and I woke up and I said, where am I? You know, I didn't know where I was and all. It just was all that. So they hopped in the car, took them to the Mayo Hospital. And they ran a CAT scan and an MRI. The technicians that did the MRI, they came back and they're really mad. He said, why don't you tell us you have shrapnel in your head? I said, well, am I supposed to? I said, we didn't have, back in World War II, we didn't have, I didn't even see an x-ray. I said, we didn't have MRIs, CAT scans, all that stuff. They were taken to the hospital, and if you had pieces from a mine or something full of shrapnel, and they'd take the big piece off, and the rest they just left there. You know,
yeah.
That's true. They would leave it there.
So they were upset because the metal had messed up the MRI?
Yeah. So I said, it's not metal. I said, it's brass and lead, you know.
Uh-huh.
I said, it's not, you know, iron or bullet, you know.
How much pain were you in when you got hit, when you came to, when you're recovering from that?
I didn't have too much, you know.
It's just skin deep. Didn't break any bones.
No.
Didn't penetrate the skull, nothing like that.
You know, it cracked the skull. You can feel the hole in there.
There's still a dent.
A lot of it's gone down before. It used to be more than that, but it's you can feel the hole in there. And I don't know where the hit pieces went up from the helmet, you know, when it hit the helmet.
So how long was it before you were back out there?
A week.
A week. Got shot in the head, shrapnel all over, and a fractured skull.
Yeah, unless you lost an arm, a leg, and they couldn't do anything, they would ship it to England or they ship it to the States. I had a couple of friends that were wounded down, and they wound up going home.
Was your mindset any different after that, after you'd been hit and almost killed?
No, I just kept on going like the rest of them.
And a month later, you got hit again?
Yeah.
What happened that time?
I was on the other side of Forbach. There was another railroad there. We're in the forest. When we went across to the north part of the town, they had rows of like a big levee, and the Germans had their 81 mortars set up. And when we took that part of it, they took their mortars with and went across another railroad track. They had some big coal mines and stuff up in that area. And as we went over that part, heck, you could see where they were mortaring us back there. There was still a stack of mortar shells that they left there, big piles of it there, you know. Mm. And that night we're on the railroad, and it was like 20 feet up the railroad, and we're down here in the forest in a big swamp area down there. The Germans were on this side, and we're on this side. So the company commander, Roger Canardi, they said, well, go ahead and attack, you know. He said, went back, said, no, I'm not attacking. He said, we'll lose everybody going over that railroad just like sitting ducks, you know. There's no cover, nothing. You're going over a ridge, and they're back there aiming at, you know.
Waiting for your head to pop up over the ridge.
Yeah. So you freeze to go down there. So in the meantime, we were dug in foxholes. I was back here in a kind of a swamp area like that, and the railroad was right there. So me and Ross there made a big foxhole right here in the night, and then they open up with a small, I don't know what they call it, little mortars. Behind there, they dug, well, not holes, but they dug underneath the railroad and had openings just below there, see, up at that end. This way we didn't have them because it was kind of swampy here where I was, but they went underneath there and they saw these guys digging in, you know. We had a couple guys who only been with us like 2 or 3 days. They were given 2 weeks of infantry training in England and sent as replacements. Guys have been sitting in England, you know, for years.
Yeah.
And one guy, I think it would have been 2 days with us. I didn't get to know him. But anyway, they were standing in the foxhole digging, and the guys went below the railroad in these holes and opened out. And he was one of them killed, the other one, 2 or 3 wounded. And then that night, Ross and I were in this foxhole, and we'd take turns, and we all sleep in there. pitch dark. Braille would come up there, and then we hear all this kind of, not rattling, but, you know, steps, like people crunching through the weeds and stuff, came over there, and there, I don't know, six or seven of them were coming back around. We didn't know if anybody was down there, because I didn't see anybody from our outfit. Our outfit was over here, and I don't know who was down there or beyond that. But the Germans came over the top of the saw, and were come out this way. We heard them, so I opened up on them, and Ross did too, and they fired back. I'm sitting there, and they came over the fence, and I'm firing like that at them down there, and I don't know if I got any or not. Next thing I know, this, when the bullets hit me, was right through here.
Right through here.
Yeah, all these,
knuckle?
Well, yeah, see where it came out? It came out right there. Yeah, all these bones were broken.
On your left hand.
Yeah,
got you right in the middle of the hand. So now you can't even really handle your weapon, right?
No. I can still fire it. I mean, you know, with one arm.
And that had to hurt.
Yeah.
All those nerves bundled up in there.
Yeah, I had all those bones. Well, they're all broken. You can feel all that. It's just a big pile of bones there.
But in the moment, you've been hit again.
Yeah.
Same city where you got hit the first time. Your hand's bleeding all over the place. So what do you do?
Well, they took me down. Somebody brought in a Jeep and they hauled me down, not even a quarter mile, of two or three blocks where the aid station was. And they patched it all, and then they sent me to the 93rd Evac Hospital. I woke up, I think the next day or something. I look over there and everything was white, and I didn't know where I was. It could have been heaven, I don't know, really. And then these two, I found they're nuns. They have those big deals like this, a French deal, you know. They wear those caps, real like flying wings, you know. I said, where am I at? I couldn't figure out where I was.
Uh-huh.
All that, you know. Then I came to later on. There was the next guy next to me, and then they put us on a train, and I went to the Second General Hospital in Nancy, France. And I was there maybe a week, and then they shipped me to the Third General Hospital, which is out of Marseille, at X, A-I-X, X-Yvonne, they call it. And I was there about a month. That was really, we had guys, I could walk. We had a lot of guys that could walk. We had at least five guys that were all shot right in here. I mean,
between the legs,
nothing. Yeah. One guy said, oh, I don't care. He says, I got three kids at home anyway. And then we go in another ward, and they had all these guys that had been really shot up, stringing up all over. We had one guy there who was on his stomach and his back with ropes hanging all over. What happened to him? He was running down the hill, and they opened up with 88s, and he saw it coming out. It was a dud. It hit in the ground and came up flipping over, and he thought he could outrun it, and he started to run down there, and it landed it right on his back and didn't go off. He had the whole back crushed there. And then we had another guy there. I'd go turn the paper. He was reading down there. I could turn with my hand. He had lost both arms and both legs. And his body was just full of shrapnel. They didn't take most of it out. So he'd read. I'd go flip pages. Or what happened to him is he was, I don't know what outfit he was in. It was at nighttime. Somebody got wounded. So the four of them and him, who's a medic, went out to get him. And on the way back, somebody stepped on the mine, killed them all except him. And he just lost both legs and both arms.
So he loses both legs and both arms, and I want people to hear what you were saying.
Yeah.
You said while you were in the same hospital as him, you would go over and sit next to him and flip the pages of the newspaper so he could read it.
Yeah, or the book he was reading, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what I'm hearing here is as painful as your injuries were and would probably be devastating for a lot of us, it sounds like you had the perspective that you could be in a lot worse shape because you had those guys all around you.
Yeah.
How hard was that to see and consider?
Well, really sad, you know, for this one guy. He lost both arms, both legs. His body was just full of shrapnel. They'd take the big pieces off, and he had little pieces just leave in, you know.
And what was the recovery like for you? How long did it take you before you could use your hand a little bit again?
I don't know, about 3 weeks or so. And by the end of the month, I went up at the Epinal replacement depot and went back to my outfit.
And there were a few other memorable experiences he had after returning to his unit. They're included in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. But when we come back, we're going to move ahead to the rest of John Chavez's military story. Remember, he was training to be a pilot when he was rerouted to the infantry? Well, after World War II, those boyhood dreams of flying would become reality. He would go on to fly bombers in the Korean War and in Vietnam. We'll hear about that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with a man who spent 3 decades in our armed forces, a recipient of the Purple Heart twice over for his time with the 70th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II. We're going to hear how John Chavez later fulfilled his dream of becoming a pilot, eventually retiring from the Air Force as a lieutenant colonel with more decorations than we have time to list. After that, he spent nearly 20 years as an inspector pilot with the Federal Aviation Administration. He enjoys reading his son's award-winning journalistic work with the Toledo Blade newspaper in Ohio, and he's proud that his daughter caught his love of flying. She's a longtime flight attendant who got to tend personally to her dad on an honor flight from Arizona to Washington, D.C. And all of these little bullet points provide a little perspective.
You ever stop to think that none of those people, your kids, grandkids, great-grandkids, would have ever been born if that shrapnel in your head did a little more damage or the one through your hand hit something else?
Yeah.
How do you explain that? Because you saw death all around you. You saw all kinds of guys going down.
Yeah, we lost, like I said, and even our book here. This is all the ones that were killed in action from our company only here.
From your company, yeah.
These are all that were wounded from our company. I'm in there listed somewhere in there.
Yep. What comes to your mind when you see these names, guys who didn't get to come home?
It's kind of sad, you know, that you know, they didn't make it back. I mean, you know, just luck of the draw, I guess. I don't know. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time, so.
Yeah. You know, I know it's always dangerous to make assumptions, but I think a lot of people would assume that if you were wounded twice in World War II, that when you got home from the war, you wouldn't be looking to get back in the military or to go fly airplanes. But that's what you decided to do.
Well, I was a kid. I said I used to make model airplanes, and all that's what I wanted to be. You
know, yeah.
I came home in 46. I had a couple of days with my wife before when I wasn't married. And I came back, and we started going out and got married in May 27, 1946. Married for 64 years and 8 months. So I went to work on the ranch with my dad and doing all kinds of work, and it was hot. And I remember one time when I was there, we were cleaning vines, muscatel vines, you know, and the Johnson grass grows around them. Had a row of fig trees all around the farms. Those days are gone. Anyway, I came back to the side there, and I'm sitting there, and I just peeled right over, unconscious. And so they hauled me up to what's called Sam's house. He was the big brother, and one of the brothers was Burge's brother. Anyway, they had the paramedics there, and I guess they used salt and all that fine gum too, and I guess I had heat stroke there. Mm-hmm. Being up there in the winter time and all that, and then coming home here, you know.
Sure.
Going up in 100-degree heat. And
your body been through the ringer.
So then I really don't take the heat that well. My daughter, my youngest daughter, the same thing.
And then you got in the Air Corps, or the Air Force, I guess, by that time.
So I saw an article in the paper said, if you've been an aviation cadet under Article so-and-so, you can now reapply for aviation cadets. You had to beat the minimum age of 20 and a half to 26, and you had to pass a physical and all that stuff again. So I applied. I came over to Mather in 1949, took all my tests again. I got the orders for pilot school at San Angelo, Texas. So I went down there and spent 6-7 months, and my wife came over and had to find an apartment. All 50% of our class was married, and 50% had come back and been in aviation cadets before and came back under this ruling. And the other half, we had about 120-some in our class, and after the first month, we lost about 30. Next month, we lost another 30 more. And a lot of young kids, and they're been the service. Oh, I wanted to take this and all that, and they resign and, you know, and go back. Well, I was in the military and all that, so I had to stick it out. You know, I was married and had a little girl at that time. We had a Marine guy who came back. He had like 3 or 4 kids.
Well, and that makes me wonder. So, you know, when you're over there in World War II, you don't have a wife, you don't have kids, but you end up flying B-29s in the Korean War. How many missions?
About 37, 38, I guess.
And you do have a wife and a child back home. Did that change things for you? Was that heavier?
Well, sort of. I don't know. That was my career, so I didn't really. When I was over in Europe, I'm sitting there in the foxhole one time, I see these 1,000 airplanes go by, 17, and a couple hours later, they're going back home to a nice club, nice bed, nice mess hall, and we're sitting there freezing today, eating K-rations, you know. I said, next time, I'm going to be up there.
Well, and that's the way it worked out. What can you tell me about those missions in Korea?
Well, they're all-day missions, and we didn't run into many MiGs. One of the B-29s we had there shot down a MiG, but we'd take off from Yokota Air Force Base, out there in 51 through 52, and go and bomb Pyongyang, Hamsung, you know, something, I forget, well, the MiGs take off, bomb them, Huichan Dam and the bridges across the rivers. We'd bomb it one day and we go the next day and you see all the people working on the bridges again. So we'd bomb them and you see them taking off, but we got a lot of them too, you know. And then they started building their bridges underwater a couple of feet. But you could still see them from up there, you know, trying to camouflage them. I think we lost 12 B-29s. We lost a couple of accidents. This one crew had just checked out. They got a bunch of different bodies together and made a crew. So they took off and come back. It was fog and cloudy, and he made the approach down there, and he was long on the approach with GCA, and he decided, instead of go ahead and cutting the power and landing, even if he went off the runway, he decided to go around. He had 1 and 2 engines on the left side shut down, 3 and 4 on the right side. So in that case, when you pour the power, the 29 or any airplane has outside, he has all that power, and it just goes like this.
He
took
off
and made a 180 and took half of the fireman's top of the roof, the wing, and landed down here in a big concrete area. And the tail broke off with the radar and the 2 gunners and went in the side of a building. And all of them, we went there and looked at it the next day after it happened. It was just one big ball of aluminum where it crashed straight down. And you can see arms and everything else in there. Down there, yeah. And we had another one down. We went down and we had anti-aircraft, you know, all the time going up there. And we got hit number 1, number 2 engine. Couldn't go back, so we had to land at Taegu, South Korea.
And again, sorry, but you say that like it's no big deal, but you're the pilot of this plane, and how many guys are in your crew that you're responsible for?
11.
That's 11 lives in your hands. And you lost 2 engines, is that what you said?
Yeah, so we went into Taegu, we landed, and it was dark when we landed because it was a late afternoon mission. And we landed there. We see all these lights down the runway because the runway wasn't really paved with mostly fighters there, you know. So we landed there. Everybody's lined up down the runway with their car turning the lights on and all that. So we landed. And what happened is the day before, B-26 came in here, in there. And I don't know what happened. He rolled over and just cartwheeled. And all these guys were waiting, you know, like you go to the races and see somebody crash, you know, but we didn't crash. So we spent, I think, a day and a half, and they sent a C-47 over there with mechanics, and we flew back to Yokota, left the airplane there.
Were you at all nervous or scared during that process, trying to get there and bringing it in?
Well, you're apprehensive and all that, but, you know, you still, you know, it's...
That's what you train for and prepare for, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know if most of us could handle that the same way you describe it.
I flew B-47 for 6 years, too. Alaska, Japan, went to Hong Kong, been on Guam.
How many total hours do you have in the air?
Well, including my FAA time, about 22,000 somewhere.
And in addition to all those missions in Korea, you flew B-52s in Vietnam?
Yeah, out of Guam, yeah. In fact, I was in the first... Well, what happened, we launched 30 airplanes. The wing commander was up here with Major Wortman. Wing commander flying lead, and I'm second, and then Dick Ayanata behind me, 3 ship cells. Then you hit the tankers this side of the Philippines. You have in-flight refueling, take on 125,000 pounds, and to go to Vietnam, come back. So we were there. We lost our radar. So the lead's here. So we pulled in number 2 position here. We're going. Dick Ayanata, they lost their radar. So he pulled in number 3. All the rest of them are still flying, you know, in their cell. So we came over to the target. We dropped their bombs at the same time he dropped there, and the 3 of us peeled around. So that was June the 18th, 1965. So you can say I was in the first flight to drop iron bombs in Vietnam.
That was a historic moment.
Yeah, I flew about another 40-some missions there out of Guam. Well, we had 2 trips. We were there about, got in February of 65 and got home in October. 4 months later, we went back again for another tour because they didn't have any other wings that were checked out with iron bombs, you know. They only had 2. It was from Seymour Johnson and us that did the training out at Wendover Bomb Range up by Salt Lake. We did the training. They had a way to the other wing to check out to replace it, see. And they finally got them checked out, so we came home. And then later on, they just started sending crew members over there.
How'd your wife feel about you being over there?
I don't know.
Did it weigh on you to be so far away from your wife and kids?
Well, yeah. We used to get on in Guam. We'd get on the Mars station, and a guy would call the guy here in the Mars station. Then he would call my wife, and then we put the kids on and say, over, out, over, back and forth.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I bought a little recorder, and I'd make tapes down there for the kids, and I'd mail them to her. And I made her a recorder so she could play them too.
So they could hear your voice?
Yeah.
An audio message.
Right.
Wow. I wonder how many dads did that.
I don't know. Not too many. But.
And I wonder how many guys who grew up in the country without electricity, got wounded twice in World War II, went on to become bomber pilots, flew in Korea, flew in Vietnam, retired as a lieutenant colonel, worked for the FAA for a long time after that. I mean, your story is pretty unique, isn't it?
I guess so. I don't know.
Before I forget, I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country for so long.
Appreciate it.
I know there are a lot of things you did in the military, but is there something that you're most proud of?
I'm most proud of I served my country to the fullest. I made it through.
Why do you think you made it through? How do you explain it?
I can't explain it. Lucky, I guess.
Did you ever feel like somebody was looking out for you?
Could have been. It wasn't my time to go, I guess, as they say.
You got to go on an honor flight with your daughter to Washington, D.C. Right. You're probably the only guy on that flight who was in all three of those wars that they have the memorials for back there. What did you get out of that experience?
Well, it was wonderful to see Uncle in the Vietnam Memorial. I have a lot of friends that were listed or killed over. A lot of them were my classmates that flew fighters over in North Korea or South Korea at that time, you know. I lost about 6-7 of my classmates over there. They're all in the memorial, and I lost some from in Guam. In fact, a navigator in the mid-air collision we had there in 65, he came out of my navigator when he bailed out. He lives in Oklahoma. We're still getting in touch. My old co-pilot, Wayne Dish, lives in Florida. I talked to him. Here I have my last co-pilot here, Frank Steele. He lives right in Roseville, and my gunner lives over in Elk Grove, so we get together every month.
The three of you flew all those missions together.
Yeah, and then we have all three of us wear our hats.
The B-52 hat.
We're going, people look over and, you know, all gray-haired. And when you're in the crew, you kind of always go together, you know what I mean?
Yeah. With the honor flight, going back there, and you see the World War II Memorial and the gold stars for 406,000 who died.
In
Korea, more than 50,000. In Vietnam, 58,000 names on that wall. Right. And you said some of those were your buddy. In your mind, what's the significance of those memorials? What should Americans who go there and see them, what should they take away from that experience, or what do we need to remember about what those memorials represent?
It's what they did for you, for the country and all, you know. It represents all the sacrifices they put up.
You came pretty close to making that same sacrifice.
Right.
And if you'd like to see a short video of Mr. Chavez pointing out where he was hit with those German bullets in 1945 and get a feel for just how close he came to not coming home, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll also find online the podcast version of this episode, including additional stories that wouldn't fit into our radio time today. I'm often asked how we find these amazing Americans that we have the privilege of meeting each week on Hometown Heroes, and the answer, by and large, is that you, the listener, find them for us. Thanks to Debbie Puchigian for pointing me toward her late father's best friend. And now you know, if you're ever in the Sacramento area and you see three gentlemen wearing B-52 hats, you can go shake their hands, thank them for serving our country, and maybe those other two crew members will tell you some stories about their pilot that John Chavez was too humble to tell himself. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. Well, I know Mr. Chavez sure enjoyed his Honor Flight experience with his daughter. And if you're like me, you enjoyed hearing some of his stories. So here's some more of those memories from World War II, starting with when he recovered from his injuries and returned to his unit.
And my outfit was in Emmerswiler, and we were the only company in Germany at that time of the 7th Army. You can look across this creek to the big factory down there. You can see the Germans walking around out there, and you see them every afternoon. This one guy would take these great big cans of food, be walking down there. We'd take a pock shot at him down there, and he'd duck and run, you know, really. And then we sent patrols out there, and one of the patrols, it was wintertime, we had snow, and they went patrolling across to the factory, trying to see what was up there. And well, the Germans come up there, and they could hear the Germans kind of surrounding them, and there's no place to go, so they jump in this creek. And they came down the creek with water, and they came out at Emmerswiler. Anyway, we could see them over there, and they would mortar us, and we'd mortar him, but they weren't really attacking or something, you know, waiting for them. And so Roger Cunardi, our company commander at that time, had a friend that was flying P-47s out of France. So he called them up and said, I'm going to come and bomb in that factory for us. So they came on, four P-47s came over the next day, and they were circling around. They dropped their 500 pound, took around the next one down there, you know. And you can sit right there. We're right across the street, like from here, maybe to across the street, that house is down there. You can see the old concussion each time, you know.
Just watching the show, huh?
Yeah, watching the show.
I can't help but feel like, as you describe the things that you went through and the things that happened to you, it sounds like no big deal. But this was your life. They almost took it a couple times. And those are the times where they hit you. I'm sure there's a lot of times where they came real close to hitting you.
Yeah, you got to file orders.
What did your family know back home?
I just had my dad.
Did he get word of you being wounded?
Oh, yeah, they gave him a card. I got the cards over here in one of my books there. Before taking Forbach, we had to take this little town of Oettingen. One of the other regiments, about a month before that, tried to take this Oettingen and going in there, and they didn't take the town, but the Germans had, it was like a big plain, and then the houses were up here and in some hills, and they had these split trenches that go like this, zigzag, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So we got to that part of the trenches there after they got beaten out of there, and they didn't take it. They tried to, but they didn't make it, so the Germans beat them and chased them back out, I guess. Anyway, we went to that part of it, spend the night in those trenches, and then the Germans were in these houses, and we're in a kind of a little hill like this, flat round. We're back on this side, and we could see the top of the hills. And this one German with a two-story house, he'd come up there once in a while from upstairs with his burp gum, and he'd spray everybody down there, and then he would disappear, and we'd just open up on that building, try to, you know. And there were snipers back in the woods too. We didn't see him. One guy was running from this side for some reason, come across, and he got shot in this arm, but where it hit him, I saw him in the hospital later. It cut all his tendons, or his arm was just like this, no circle, nothing, just saw him in the hospital, and they were sending him to the States because they couldn't do anything, you know, maybe retire or something anyway. So we took that town, that little town of Oettingen, but we're on the left side before we get to Forbach, the big castle, and we're going house to house. The Germans were on this side. There's some big orchards on it. There's a big wall of rocks that people had around their orchards and stuff there. So we come up there, and we're searching this house. So it's a French-German, you know, their mixture in there for the years.
Sure.
So I went in there, and everybody's searching. Nothing there. I don't see anything down there. And I saw a big pile of clothes, dirty clothes up here in the corner. So I went in there. I started moving the clothes over there. I didn't fire into it, and I had the BR. I went and started moving down there. Pretty soon there's a young, at least he was about 16, 17, German hiding. And I think it must have been their father and mother, you know, but he was German, you know, they impressed a lot of the guys in the army.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, told him to rouse out, you know, and oh, and the mother and father all crying, all that. And I took him out across the street. There's dirt, like a dirt wall, not a wall, just dirt road here. But just, I said, get over there and stand up there. And I had the BAR, and all these people thought I was going to shoot him. Hollering at me, you know, and crying, all that. No, I just, I wasn't going to shoot him down there. And they took him back to POW, and then we kept moving down through the woods and then went to Forbach.
What did it feel like to find out that Germany had surrendered?
I was coming back from the hospital. I was in Villeroux, France, below Luxembourg. They go through a replacement depot, and they take you back to your own outfit now, and you have to go through all that, you know, and get a new gun, new uniform. I was sitting there, and we went into this little town, Villeroux. It's flat, but there's a canyon. You go down there, and there is a town in through these canyons down there, Villeroux, and it's a big mining, coal mining area. Mm. So we went down there, and just before the war ended, on our way back, and we went down there, and there was an old bar down there in town. We went in there and just, I didn't drink at the time, we just went in and visited, and had these two pretty French gals there, and the guy was the owner, and that was the father. And the father started speaking English, and I said, where'd you learn English and all that? What happened, he was in World War One, and he stayed there and married this French gal. Then he come back, and he run this bar, you know.
What are the odds?
Yeah, it was funny. So we came back the next day, and all of a sudden we're going back into town. They said the war is over and all that, and everybody's, you know, cheering and all that.
Was that a relief for you?
Yeah, kind of. It was over, you know. Then I wound up joining my outfit. Was in Niederhausen, out of Limburg and Dietz, which is north of Wiesbaden in Frankfurt. Mm-hmm. Little village down there. Well, we did not much patrolling down there, but we'd go over and take a house over and say, hey, we got this house, and people would move us someplace else, and we'd take over a house, you know. We had this one house. A lady was about gray-haired, a little mother, and her daughter was there, and they had a little kid. The kid's dad was in the, had been fighting the Russian army. He hadn't come back yet. And the little kid was, I got pictures of him, Tita. I remember it was Tita. And there was another fan with some German girls, and one German girl would come back, and we always, guys try to get a picture, and she always duck her head, didn't want to talk, you know, really, you know, indoctrinated, you know, German kids then. A lot of the kids wore their little shorts from the German, trying to think.
The Hitlerjugend?
Hitlerjugend, yeah.
Yeah.
At one time, you know, they're 10, 11, 12 years old. And so we went, we'd go in by Jeep over to Dietz, which is, I don't know, 5-6 miles. And we had a big German prisoner of war camp there, and it was full. And that's where we were guarding them. Hmm. And I remember the river down here was a dam, and the town there, Limburg and Dietz, they're together. Right on the back of the, it looked like an old schoolhouse that they used for prisoner war camp. There was a pile of jail helmets down there, like 1,500 of them. I mean, a huge pile of GI helmets there. And was, they held American prisoner at one time. And after they deliberated, and then they put German prisoners in there after the war. Then I wound up going from there. We moved to Gießen. From Gießen, we went to Wetzlar. And in Wetzlar, I got transferred to the 3rd Infantry Division. That was a K Company, 30th Infantry Regiment, 3rd Division, in Bad Suden-Ellendorf. There was a river there, and it was way down. You see castle on the side of this valley, you know. And we were out patrolling here, and we had outposts. And right across the outpost was the Russians at that time. That was the line, the Russians. And they had their machine guns set up, you know, and we had a big old tent. We lived in town, you know. We just took over a great big house down there. Everybody had their own room and all that. But we'd go up there. had a big tent, and I remember for a while we had a mess hall there in town. It was the old beer hall, and we'd go down there with our GI mess kits, and we'd eat, come back, and we'd come out the back door, and they had a garbage can there, and a place to wash your mess, you know, and just dip it in there. All these little kids and old women were there with their little cans, you know, for any food left over, guys left over, and, you know, you give them to them. And the guys that smoked, they would smoke so far, and they'd throw their butts down there, and all the kids would jump over and fight over the cigarettes, you know. They had a big lake over there we'd go swimming in, but we'd go with the Russians. We'd walk up to them, and they couldn't speak American. We couldn't speak Russian. We just kind of say hello and kind of walk back in the woods, you know. And during that part of the late 45, Russians were taking over, so a lot of the German people didn't want to be in East Germany. A lot of them had moved there with the bombing, so they're all coming back through the woods. And they'd be dressed carrying their packs, and they have like four or five sweaters on, three skirts, you know, ready to load it to bring all that, you know, families and all that. And the Russian would stop them down there, but once they got through the Russians, if they did get through to come on, we just let them go on home wherever they're going, let them on through. Yeah, well, we got a couple of guys, and we were flying this one hill, Hill 415, out of Wingen. After we took Wingen, we went up then and fought in the hills, 415. And B Company took off Hill 405, and it was up like this winter. The Germans were up here looking right down our throat through the woods, and they're firing from 88s from the other side, tree bursts. And we had, I had two friends of mine. Well, they're both gone now. Side by side, they're close to foxholes, and they got a burst. They were both wounded and sent home. We had a lot of them wounded with that. Mm-hmm. And the Germans looking right up our throat. We had a lot of pine trees and guys trying to hide behind pine trees. I went there in 205, took my son. We went through all. I got a lot of video I took in that area. In the hill, there was a 405, and there was a saddle like that. And the Germans here, the old foxholes are still there that they built long ones, you know.
Yeah.
And so we finally were able to take that hill. But when in 205, when I went up there, there was an old guy with a tractor lumbering some of the old trees. And they weren't pine trees, another tree. And you can see where they were cut. And you see all these gray areas where bullets had gone in there from the lead, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I took a picture of those or not. But anyway, we took that and we came back, and I'm down on the bottom of the hill, six or seven of us. And they said, we're expecting a counterattack from the hills coming down the snow. He said, set up the 50 caliber machine gun over here, you know. Nobody knew how to operate a 50 caliber, so I went up there, got it started and loaded up, you know, because I used to be AR. Loaded them, we sat there practically freezing. And then pretty soon one, Trudell was his name, he came down with another one. And he had like six or seven Germans. And a lot of them were shot up and hollering and crying, you know, and all that. So they brought a 2.5-ton truck down, and we loaded them up. And Trudell was in our company. He was shot right through the jaw here. He was bleeding and all that, you know. So to get him to the hospital or to the medics there. So he sat in the back. All the Germans here, and they're all hollering, you know, they're all badly wounded. And I'm sitting on this side, he's over there, and he tells the German, you guys shut up or I'm going to shoot you all. That's what he said, you know. So we took him down to the evac hospital, and we dumped the POWs. I forget where we got rid of them, down there somewhere. I remember, and came back. And then from there, we went to, that's when I moved over to Emmerswiler. Anyway, somebody else replaces there in that same hill we took over.
Yeah.
And a week later, they were counterattacked, and they were all driven back out again and captured, most of them.
Good thing they relieved you when they did, for you, yeah. Anyway.